Hey guys, I'm delighted to be back with Daniel DeMartino Booth of Quill Intelligence, founder and CEO, and of course, a former Fed advisor at the Dallas Fed. Daniel, delighted to have you back. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me again.
Wow. You know, last time I said you're the lady of our time because it's all about the Federal Reserve. It's all about monetary policy. It's all about the debt explosion, the changes in the yields, the loss of value on the debt. Are we at the secular end? Because we came out post-COVID and said that was a final capitulation or a blow-off in values for the bond markets. And we say big technical trends typically end like that. Are we going to be proven correct that this is the end of the 40-year bull in debt? And how is the Fed going to handle this? What's your takes on what we should be seeing with regards to debt markets?
So if we are at the end, if this is what it is, then I don't think anybody can tell you what the other side is going to possibly look like because of the specter of the credit markets being as big as they are. So you're talking about, I don't do hyperbole at all, but if this really is the end, and we really are going to see real rates rise appreciably, then you are talking about a global depression.
And of a synchronized and macronomic scale. I mean, it does feel that we're getting very close to a debt reset and new systems may come on. Tell us a little bit more about, there's been a lot of announcements and movements that have happened. I mentioned to you, we've seen on the currency side, the Japanese currency losing an immense amount relative to almost across the board. And they've been talking about curve control. The ECB has hinted that they might do some curve control while America is tightening. You mentioned a beautiful phrase in our preamble that debt markets, and I refer to their overlap relationship with currency markets, that certain federal or ECB or central banker decisions on the debt market, the FX market is almost a release valve. Talk to us a little bit more about that, because I love that phraseology and what it means.
So it really is just, if you can just imagine, if there's too much pressure that's building up in a scientific way, either you're going to have an explosion or you're going to have a reaction. You're going to have some way to release that pressure. And the conduit, the transmission mechanism, is always going to be your currency. As long as your currency is theoretically something that is publicly visible, something that can be traded. And of course, people, they don't appreciate that the FX markets are by far the largest on the planet. They supersede anything that you could possibly compare them to, whether it be in the fixed income or the equity markets.
Absolutely valid and true. And something else we were also discussing preamble was there's almost a bipolar signaling service. We have the VIX on the equity side, and the equity markets seem to be in a stupor and a slumber where they're not seeing the interconnectivity of the financial system, because on the move, the MOV, which is the volatility index for those that are just checking in, we're seeing an incredible increase in the volatility as a result of the debt markets. What is the market missing? Why aren't they seeing? Why is there no response?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that you really have, especially on the fixed income side, you've lengthened your maturities to a certain extent where credit is the riskiest. And because of that, you're starting to see EM blow up, emerging markets blow up more rapidly than, say, the junk bond market in the United States. Certain countries have less room, less wiggle room, but there is indeed $1 trillion worth of non-financial corporate debt that has to be refinanced in calendar year 2022. And I would argue that though we're not seeing defaults and we're not seeing the onset of what we would consider to be a default cycle, we will indeed start to see a lack of a release valve, if you will, if the issuance markets don't behave. And what we're watching right now is issuance kind of treading water. High yield issuance is not necessarily wide open, but it's also not closed in the same way that it did in 2018, which gave Powell, you know, such a fright that I argue that it scarred him. We're not seeing that yet, but the MOVE index is saying it's coming and be prepared. And the stock market is saying, no big deal, we're gonna ignore it. And again, every single time we see a tick up in rates and nothing happens, nothing is transmitted through to the equity markets, you'll have one more Fed speaker come out and be that much more hawkish. And they're trying to push the envelope of tightening without actually having to tighten. They're trying to jawbone their way into tighter financial conditions. And the stock market is basically saying, no. They're saying, no, not until you prove it will I actually react. Not until you remove liquidity from the system through quantitative tightening will I throw a fit, because until then, the most I've seen is 25 basis points. Come check back with me again. And so then they'll throw Bullard out and he'll say, oh, we need 75 basis points. Until the stock market sees actual action, it's not going to react. The bond market, however, is reacting to the reality of higher interest rates.
It sounds like you're describing a game of chicken. Where literally two truckers are going head on. And one of them is saying, I'm going to do this. And the other one is saying, I'm not listening to what you say. I'm listening to what you actually do. You're 8% behind and you did a quarter point. That tells me you're ambling after a bullet train that's long left the station and you're never going to catch it. And it's not your intention.
Jay Powell danced around the question at the IMF. He was asked pointedly, were you one of those many who you just said many on the committee were advocating for a 50 basis point hike? And he said, well, I certainly wouldn't reveal my own position. So he did the dance. And he said, but there were many who were advocating for 50 basis points in May, and May could very well be appropriate. It's on the table for sure. And then he kind of back walked a bit and said, of course, going forward, it will be a meeting by meeting decision. And that's what the stock market hears. And that's why stocks are relatively so much more well-behaved than the worst first quarter we've seen in the bond market since 1973.
It feels like the Fed has two girlfriends, one in the debt market and one in the equity market, and is trying to keep them both sweet by talking a different tale out of different sides of their mouth. I find that hysterical. You were starting to touch on the debt, especially the high yield debt market. I mean, last time, it was 2018, you described, I actually had a fistful of puts on HYG, only to have the abnormal event of the Federal Reserve standing behind the HYG high yield. And just preamble, when we were having a pre-chat, I mentioned, will they do it again? Or could I be stacking up on that position again on the basis that debt needs to go down? We've got this macro view, of course, of debt short and macro long on the commodity section. Of course, deflationary strikes will tame the commodity market to a degree if we are to have the full spill. But inside of that, what will be different this time that makes that trade possibly a viable one?
So I think I'm going to give you a bit of a history and humanities and demographic lesson. Your average senator in the United States is somewhere in their mid-60s, about 20 years older than your average American. That makes a difference. The reason that is because we don't have term limits imposed upon our politicians. It's been very harmful to the U.S. economy because we haven't had people in positions of leadership who've been able to stand up to the Federal Reserve. Over multiple generations. So the damage that Greenspan did, the damage that Bernanke did, Yellen, who followed him, she's still doing damage right now. This comes down to the fact that you can dust off members of Congress, except for Pat Toomey of the state of Pennsylvania. Pat Toomey has committed himself to term limits. He is the one who stood in front of Sarah Bloom Raskin recently and caused the Senate Banking Committee to walk out every time they tried to vote on somebody who wouldn't provide information. And so he wouldn't push forward with a confirmation hearing of somebody who wouldn't do full financial disclosure because they were going to be voting for her to be the banking regulator of the nation. And so that was Pat Toomey. In December of 2021, before Trump was leaving office, right before he signed that final bit of stimulus that gave that second stimulus check out, there was a stipulation inside of that legislation. Pat Toomey wrote it himself. He was the author. Again, he leaves office in 2022. He's committed to term limits, so he's able to do things that other politicians who are beholden to their lobbyists and their donors are not able to do. And he said, we must turn off the credit facilities at the Federal Reserve. You're not going to do a blue state backdoor bailout with that municipal bond facility by flipping it back on and off at need. Oh, look, Illinois or New Jersey, they're going to blow up to kingdom composite because their pension system's so underfunded. At the same time, he took out of operation the credit facilities that blew up your puts and said, and it's written into the law, if you are to flip this on, whoever the incoming Treasury Secretary is going to be, we didn't know at the time, we do now, it's Janet Yellen. Whoever that Treasury Secretary is legally cannot flip the switches back on those BlackRock off-balance sheet Treasury-based facilities unless there is a new black swan, a new unusual and exigent circumstance. This is written into the Fed code. It's a small section 13C. But that is the law right now. They can't just say, oh, look, high yield is falling out of bed. By the way, it's $3 trillion, that market, and growing. You cannot just flip a switch on. And
but
that,
won't they manufacture something that meets those criteria, in essence? Isn't it a case of, we'll find a way, and this is a new event. It's a credit crash. We've got to intervene. This is exceptional.
Very possibly. Absolutely. Look, we are talking about the United States Congress, the most dysfunctional entity on the planet. And they will bow to markets if markets are truly in a state of upheaval. However, there's still not the legalese. There's not an ease with which to do this like the flip of a switch. You still have to come up with a reason. And
so we're going to have to see a fair level of stress in that system before they'll be able to re-engage.
Even if the Treasury and the Federal Reserve desire to put those facilities back into being, there's going to be a little bit more of a time lag. And when there's a time lag and risk has been unleashed in the credit markets, they were able to come in very quickly, March 23rd, 2020. And they were able to really staunch, they were able to get, put their finger in the wound and stop the bleed.
Yeah.
Will take them a little bit more time, and I dare say that Jay Powell knows the damage that he's created by rescuing the BBB right above junk sector of the investment grade bond market by grandfathering that in as part of those BlackRock off balance sheet vehicles. So yes, to answer your question, your puts could blow up again, but you've got a little bit longer lead time because of legislation that's been written, and that was probably more answer than you ever wanted. But it's
no,
the only
I love it.
That encourages me.
The detail you provided there is absolutely fascinating. Yield curve inversions, if we can pivot to this. So my overall position on how at a market level these things are gonna unfold is that there's far less time than people. So the minute we get yield curve inversions, there's a lot of people that run cover for it, and they say, yes, but it'll be different this time, etc. You've got 17 months. Stock markets have typically gone up a lot higher in the period intervening. You're going to have 17 months on average, sometimes 10, sometimes 33. And our opinion is the sensitivity has got so acute that, and the momentum, you touched on this, which I think we concur to a massive degree, is that the capitulation into that inversion was so brutal and with such high momentum. And now, in fact, 30 and 2, which is not as common, but never inverted during the events of March 2020-19, has inverted for the first time since the GFC. What's your take on how much time? Because the risks are clearly all to the downside, but many people want to play in the traffic a little longer and pick up pennies. And my overall take is that's a very, very dangerous game. There's a fast lane with a Porsche turbo coming at 300 miles, and you're going to get absolutely ridden over if you go for this. You haven't got the same time frame that people want to assume. Do they have the aggregate amount of time, or are we more sensitive? And could the lightning strike a bit sooner than most people expect?
So my only caveat before I jump in is that there are too many people of our viewpoint right now, and that always scares me. It scares me when I'm not in the teensiest of minorities.
Yes.
That said, the sell side is equally united in saying 18 to 24 months, even though the yield curve was only inverted for a hot minute. The fact is, if you look back at eras that involve policy errors, you look back to the double dip recession of 1980. So the U.S. economy came out of recession July of 1980, and the yield curve inverted September of 1980. 10 months after that, we were in recession. That is the formerly the shortest time period between inversion and going into recession. Of course, there was only 7 months from the moment of yield curve inversion until COVID hit. So that was another short time frame. The reason that I dispute the 18 to 24 month here, it's going to be okay, is that we're talking about periods that involved a 10-year and a 12-year economic expansion. What we're seeing right now is few dispute that we're in very mature late cycle, whatever lovely diplomatic term you want to throw to it, the end of the days, much less diplomatic, but we're definitely late cycle. And yes, we're late cycle inside of a time compression chamber. This has occurred inside of two and a half years. So for us to be saying that we're late cycle, for the Philly Fed, which I'm writing about for tomorrow's Feather, for the Philly Fed to be signaling distress on such a level, they're building up inventories to such an extreme that 6 months out, they're anticipating not buying anything to the same level as they lasted in the 1970s. Forget the great financial crisis, forget the 1990 recession. Stockpiling the United States has become so acute because everybody's freaked out that they're not going to get things from China. And there's this war in Ukraine, but you've got purchasing managers telling you. You had 125 CEOs from the Philly Fed, which is the chemical hub of the United States. That's the beginning of the pipeline for manufacturing. Chemicals are at the very start.
Fertilizer,
That inside of 6 months, we're at least in an industrial recession, at the very least in a stagflationary environment.
Yeah, I've almost referred to this as a hyperstagflationary environment. It's almost, it feels like an inverse Goldilocks era that Greenspan bequested on us, because we went from a globalization state where we got incredible lower cost offshoring benefits as a result that they were able to run interest rates artificially low in as a result of the inflationary benefit we got on these low cost producers. And that led to an asset price boom. So people forget that inflation is also in the asset classes often before it comes into the prices, the consumer prices. And now we feel like we're getting the deglobalization, which is the unwinding of that, especially following the Russia-Ukraine events. And on top of that, so we're reducing the workshop availability we can source from. And on top of that, we're going to have almost a stubbornly high inflation. Virtually, hyper is a bit too extreme, but I think we're in a real sense double digits, and that's the beginning of hyperinflationary levels. And surely the consumer is actually quite weak out there. I love it when Jay Powell says, with such a strong labor market and all of these narratives, and Biden was almost claiming pride on the GDP number being high, and that of course is on an inflated dollar. Are we in a really stubbornly high stagflation? Are we going to get an inverse Goldilocks? And how does it end? Does it end in reset, or is there a way of managing out of this?
I don't think there's a way of managing out of it, but I do think that you raise the point that there are many cross currents. And when you're talking about companies sitting on inventory and for the first time in multiple generations having to shoulder the cost of carrying inventory, we're no longer just in time. With a weakening consumer, your pricing power gets decimated in these kinds of environments. And that's why even though your input prices may stay high, if you're sitting on inventory and your demand is coming down, that's why we're seeing work weeks, expected work weeks come down. We're seeing job openings. They're still up year over year, but we're seeing the pace of job openings come down very quickly. So the disinflationary impetuses are going to be multiple in nature. A lot is going to be also variable. How was the crop season in the United States? How much infrastructure was destroyed in Ukraine? How much wheat can they get out? Will they get a second full season for planting wheat? Because they have not one but two in Ukraine. So a lot of the determinants of inflation going forward are going to be very much of a variable nature, as opposed to, China shut down, it's going to introduce all new supply chain disruptions. Well, that's true on the supply side, but is there that much demand coming from the United States such that disruption is going to be caused at our ports? Or are our manufacturers choking on inventory and beginning to communicate that to us. So, and by the way, if the consumer is getting weak and if interest rate sensitive sectors such as autos and housing are weakening, are we going to start seeing, say 6 months out, are we going to start seeing this weakness come through, finally filter through? We're seeing pressure on home sales in the United States outside of the investor community. Will we start to see these biggest prices come down? You're seeing General Motors and Ford. You're starting to see incentive spending again to get people to buy cars. Ford Motor sells the F-150 truck. I know it probably in Europe, it probably makes absolutely no sense, but it is the gold standard. It is the best-selling vehicle in the United States. F-150 sales fell 47% on the month in May, even though they shipped out 74% more to their dealers. So this massive
channel stuffing going on there as well. The implication that there's a bit of channel stuffing going on there as well.
We're not there yet, but we are at the point where consumers are interest rate sensitive enough that they're not able to afford these nosebleed prices for autos, for housing, and they're saying so. And so, again, you could only have a situation of hyperinflation against a backdrop of possibly more stimulus, more fiscal relief, which you're not going to get in a midterm election year.
No, I get that. I mean, I've been many times to the States and I love visiting it. The American people are awesome. I enjoy visiting the country. I remember seeing one of the adverts as a little bit of a sidebar, Danielle, where F-150s were available, and they were available on, I think it was a 60-month, and there was even a possibly a 70-month, 72-month payment, and that had a balloon payment on the back end of that. And this was, I'm talking last time I was in the States, must have been 3 years ago. And essentially somebody is buying about 60% of a car with a balloon payment over the kind of period my father paid off his home loan on. And I was thinking, wow. And then now we have this interest rate cycle. I mean, the fixed 30-year deal is through 5% now, and I'm seeing the intermediaries offering sixes and more, because not everybody got perfect credit or has got the highest score. Isn't that going to take an immense amount of fist? Because there's two great ATMs for the American people, and that's the stock market, which, as we've said, probably has more risk to the downside with the VIX index not yet truly reflecting the debt element, and the housing market, which has been on a tear, but now most people being borrowers to some degree facing 5+ percentage points. How about that consumer, and what effect the net wealth effect any downturn or slowdown will have there?
It's with good reason that we're seeing credit card spending in the first quarter especially be as robust as it is, and that has to do with what you're speaking about. I think that the universe of American homeowners who can make the math work for refinancing is down to, I think, less than 10% of the mortgage universe. So very, very few people can pull money out of their homes. One of the most frightening statistics that I saw recently is that among those who are refinancing, we're seeing a pickup in FHA loans, FHA mortgages. FHA mortgages are 3.5% down for the neediest borrowers. It's a government-backed program. And so if you can imagine somebody who bought a house a year ago, they've seen their home price appreciate to a certain extent. And this is a true anecdote. So they take that 3.5% mortgage, they refinance into a 5.25% mortgage just to get $30,000 in cash out of the house. The marginal rate of interest that they're paying on that is 22% on that $30,000. It makes absolutely no sense, but it paints a picture for you of how desperate many households are to keep consuming at the levels to which they've become accustomed because the federal government was assisting such consumption.
And there's no sign and there's no appetite for furloughs in any downturn again for quite some time. It's going to really take the pip squeaking. So there's not going to be extra normal income that's going to be state provided. You've got people using credit card debt, which is probably the most expensive, apart from that which you've just described, which is going almost to the extreme on loan to value on your property and leasing that extra.
The biggest banks just reported, and the media was adorable in saying that there was all this strength being exhibited with credit card spending. And then the fine print at the very bottom showed that JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America had seen material increases in credit card loans. I'll tell you what a credit card loan is. It's when you take money as a loan from your credit card. You're just getting cash from your credit card at an average of 16.7%.
Wow. Yeah, that is super high. That's really expensive money when you consider what savers get paid. Isn't it one of the big corporate swindles that we have virtually no real recognition in our formal banking sector for postponed consumptions in terms of a saving rates, yet borrowing is so high? Doesn't it give the lie to what the true inflation rate is? Because essentially, I think you get about 0.25 as a bank saver if you're not on hold versus the aggregate consumer's access to credit, usually a credit card or a personal loan in the mid-teens.
It's the disparity is absolutely you can't even attach reason to it. And one of the narratives that is a huge pillar of the sell side is that there's this massive amount of cash that's been built up. Well, there are deposits on bank balance sheets. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But when you look at the aggregate level of nominal savings in the United States, it is below that of what it was in late 2019. So all of the money that has been given to people with the highest propensity to spend it has been spent. And that's why you're seeing such acts of desperation to get their hands on cash. But again, we're talking about Americans here. And Americans do not like to stop spending. And that's why you've got people like Jay Powell who are sitting on the laurels of the most lagging of all data, which is unemployment or employment. And then you've got retail sales on top of it, which is being supported by taking out credit. So, but these are very much, it's as if you're trying to drive on the Autobahn in Germany, going more than 100 miles an hour through the rearview mirror.
Wow, yes. That's pretty dramatic, but I would probably be forced to agree. What's the first thing to break? Clearly, we should be looking at debt markets, but it seems like the release valve is FX currencies. I mentioned the Japanese in actively doing this form of curve control, and we've seen a huge devaluation in the yen. Shouldn't everybody be watching currencies as much as debt markets as well, as part and parcel of this overlap that the people see them tend to be as siloed, as if they're, you know, they live in a vault of their own, but that in actual fact they're all overlapping taps and levers and, you know, water finding levels and different containers that the one will feed into the other. They don't see the macro system more holistically. Is there not a currency major play out that's being missed here as well with the debt?
Absolutely. I mean, pay attention to countries that are forced to import their natural gas. And with Japan being the number one in the world in terms of its dependency, South Korea being number two. There are a few other countries down on that list, Pakistan, Thailand, and they are, to me, those are the canaries I'm looking at. Because yeah, it's not an Arab Spring that we're contemplating right now, even though Egypt is in a mess right now. Egypt is on the brink. But we're not looking at an Arab Spring because, last check, Peru is not in the Middle East. No. So you're looking at a global situation right now. And that's why I think, rather than looking at HYG, even though we've definitely seen credit risk start to perk up as the move is advertising and warning and cautioning, but I'm watching how quickly the emerging market space, because they don't have the latitude, they don't have the Bank of Japan in some of these emerging markets. They don't have the same levers. They don't have the same release valves. So you see Sri Lanka simply up and say, we're defaulting. If we don't default on our debt, there's no food. And we have to have time to negotiate with the IMF. So we're just not going to pay on our debt. So we're just going to flat out default. Again, go back to the time compression chamber and how quickly these things are happening. You have twice as many emerging market countries right now with debt levels that are trading in distress, north of 1,000 basis points, north of a US Treasury. That's twice as many as you had in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic hitting. So we're in a much more dire situation here. So if you want a front row seat with popcorn, follow the EM space.
I like what you've said about EM, but the interesting thing is a lot of EMs are in the commodity space as well, and they've held up. I've actually watched the Brazilian real firm. I've watched my donkey currency of my homeland, South African rand, actually come from around 16s to 14 and a halves. gold, platinum, bit of agri, Brazil, clearly the same, you know, cacao, coffee, a lot of these things starting to get real money pricing and re-rating on the commodity long. We have to be specific to the ones that are super over indebted and are not got too much of a commodity power on energies potentially. And I'm also noticing that the what's first world, you've mentioned them, and our big bears are the USD, Korea, and won. We are expecting huge blow off moves. The Korea and Japan are not easily the Turkeys, the South Africa, and the Brazils, but I feel that there's more of a westernized Eastern nation currencies, if I can say that, those that have been pro or at least sympathetic to the westernized world, the yen, the Korean won. I feel that they are coming almost more into the headlights than you would have your usual dirt box of the emerging markets. Is there, what are the motives? We've got demographics that are working very negatively. I mean, Korea,
I think what's playing out here is that we're seeing how very vulnerable net energy importers are.
Yes.
This is not something you can fix quickly. Germany, to take but one example, is fast-tracking building out LNG ports. That's fine. At best, they're going to come online 2025, 2026. Yeah. That's a dog year in economics. Right now, months are dog years in economics. And so you're seeing how vulnerable energy net importers are. I'm going to go back to Brazil for just a second, though. Bolsonaro comes up for election in October. Guess who's spending his energy dividend right now? He is. He's pumped $35 billion into aid for the poorest people. To me, there's a parallel to be drawn between Xi Jinping and Juan Bolsonaro, because they're both doing the same thing. They're pumping as much money into their domestic economies as possible. So I would dare say that 20% appreciation in the Brazilian real might be a bit aggressive, considering that Brazil itself is already in stagflation as well.
Oh yes, the last thing I'm ever going to try sell anybody is that they are paragons in virtue and don't have incredible debt problems. But they kind of getting a small. Paraphrase this, I've just brought up a share because I've tried to do the currencies on a strength versus weakness, and you were hitting the nail on the head on a number of them when we were referring to the yen that I put as one of the most exposed. Of course, emerging markets should be in there. They don't have the same scale. But in some senses, the quality of Japan is what allowed them to get even deeper into debt than the normal emerging markets has been available. And you also hit the nail on the head when you were referring to, apart from high relative debt, it's the need for imports of commodities, specifically energies, but not exclusive to energies. And the other element I threw in there is, deep down, people are also asking how much precious metals people are holding relatively. We know what Britain did, they dumped 400 tons. And then we look at what they're doing in terms of yield control, curve control, which Japan is already involved in and the EU is contemplating. So in some senses, I'm just curious, where would you put the Brazilian real, say, for example, versus, say, the yen and the euro? We're comparing in an FX emerging that has lots of faults, admittedly, but we also have these more privileged, deemed first world nations that have almost been given a bigger overdraft and have used it. Who's the ugliest? We're doing a beauty contest in the leper colony, essentially, and we're asking who's the least ugly and who's the ugliest of them all. I'm just curious as to how do we measure that? How do we measure Brazil versus the Korean won and the yen?
Well, I think when you look at the Japanese yen having seemingly hit a ceiling of 130, that the global FX markets are telling you that if you take one more step down that pathway, that again, something is going to break. And yes. And 20% appreciation in the Brazilian real. I get that it's a net exporter. I understand it's got energy. It plants a lot. I understand all of that. But when you consider what's already been priced in, I think you have to take that and contextualize it, given China is not going to be buying as much. I'm not talking about food, but I'm talking about China's not going to be supporting global commodities exporters. Yeah. Copper, iron ore, the way that they did in 2016. They simply don't have the financing. They simply don't have the funding. And Xi Jinping has to look towards that 20th People's Congress. And so that's why I think you should parse whether or not you're talking about a food exporting nation or a metals exporting nation, because there's a distinction to be drawn if you're talking about a global industrial recession that China's not able to rescue.
Yeah. Yes. And of course, metals and construction, they've actually allowing far more of their property correction to occur than people gave credit for. And so therefore, I would imagine copper, concrete and industrial irons and ores, Australia won't get the same skipping through the great financial crisis it got when China spent for the world during that era post 09 through to 14, 15 until their Shanghai Accord in 16. That's a very interesting history and opinion. Do you have a view, because Japan was popular and famous, I'm dragging you maybe a bit out of the American economy, tell me if you're just so globally switched on, I'm sure you're comfortable here as well, but there was a carry trade syndrome in Japan in terms of speculation, because they had the lowest interest rates in the world. This was pre all the multiple QEs and we all went down the same path. What is the function of that, and is there a major carry trade unwind, or is that something that dissipated anyway when we had the normalization of our rates down to their level, or is there still some degree of structural danger in the legacy carry trade in terms of using the cheap funding to buy and now there's yen exposure?
Right. I would argue, and I'll never forget the day when I was working at the Federal Reserve at the time, that I called the director of research and said the carry trade just broke. It was a Sunday afternoon. When the Japanese yen carry trade broke, I would argue that you're seeing in the full-on reversal of negative yielding sovereign debt, that you're seeing a violent unwinding of a carry trade. And that is why you're seeing a walloping of the euro and the yen. Because again, if you're talking about the cheapest borrowing rates globally, you were going for the bund. You were going for the JGB. That's where you were playing that hand. That's where you were putting that trade on, and you can't in this kind of an environment when the Fed won't shut up.
Yeah, and are tightening. So back to what breaks first. We're all guessing, we're all scenario casting, we're all likely to be wrong, but how do you see this unbelievable quagmire we've been caught in? And I'm assuming, is it fair enough to say that you see the Fed as being badly behind the curve? How does it break?
Look, I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know what systemic looks like. I don't know what systemic looks like in this environment. I know what systemic looked like in 2018, 2019. There was this great concern that even in a rising interest rate environment, that Japanese banks were overly exposed to U.S. collateralized loan obligations. Last check, they're probably still sitting on those balance sheets. So again, I'm hyper-focused on bleed through to credit, whether you're talking about the EM space or that of the US high yield debt market, or that of Europe's high yield debt market as well. People have not been talking enough about the disruption in that market. The issuance market in Europe has been under siege longer than that, and to a greater degree than that of what we've seen in the United States. And that bears some paying attention to, because of the way that the financial market construct has changed since the pandemic. You've got more dollar denominated debt, not just in sovereigns, not just in foreign non-financials, but you've also had this massive evolution in the European bond market as well, as they've tried to step away from being so dependent upon their banking system for their leverage.
And isn't that got this whole debt instrument, hasn't this got unbelievable repercussions? I mean, Raoul did a very good on Real Vision about the plight of pensions. And of course, pension funds are inadvertently, I would describe them as the dumb money that have been holding the other end of being net purchasers of bonds on account of the annuitization principle and having some secured, stable investment. This is how it was sold. Obviously, the bonds were the boring markets. If you wanted excitement, you went to equities. And now we're in this almost inverse end of cycle where actually all the action is in the sleepy tortoise zone. And that there's serious potential repercussions for pension schemes. And this almost means that this could lead to a whole new deal. do pension schemes even have a chance actuarially of surviving the decimation of this asset class?
I mean, here's the irony, right? They've been waiting for these level of high rates for so long to match their assets, their liabilities. Now that they've got them, what liquidity do they have? Because they've got so much tied up in private equity and illiquid assets that are dependent upon the capital markets being open. So it's not as if they can flip a switch and reduce their equity exposure and increase their bond exposure just because the 30-year long bond yield is looking pretty, you know, pretty attractive right here. So there's your irony. And the risk in the pension system is so underappreciated. You know, you've got Ken Griffin putting tons of money behind trying to oust the governor of Illinois, the head of Citadel. I mentioned something that's that micro in nature, because if you have rational players at the same time that the pension system is blowing up, God help us. Because for generations now, the weakest pension players have simply been able to, and the markets have allowed them to issue more bonds like a Ponzi scheme in order to care for the underfunding situation. But in a true recession, and if capital markets were truly to seize, given how large the shadow bank has become and how exposed to alternatives pensions are, you could have a serious situation where illiquidity became a very big problem.
Yeah, and that means capitulation, because the absence of bint. The dark market, the derivative market, surely there must be untold reverberations and conversations going on with the brutal change in the yields and the loss of value in the debt markets. Could this is something so few people understand. It's almost like a black box. Could not there be some major exposures? You mentioned Japan's potential position in terms of that, maybe Korea's, but there's also big corporation players. Could we end up in a bailout situation again on account of quadrillions of closet derivatives that are all becoming deeply unsettled? And there was one other thing that occurred. Sorry, while I'm going to just addend this to this question. We saw that there was, during the period of the repo market seize, there was some incredible article that actually pointed to the better part of around 48 trillion all told. I think the highest recipient was BNP Paribas with about 3.89 trillion during the repo markets that were lent out to various 25 of the largest banks. And that was very, very dark. It didn't get covered by the mainstream media on any level. Have you come across that article? What were your thoughts about the absolute scale of the plumbing patch-up job that was done during what most people skipped through and didn't even notice? And that was the last, that was 33 months from the previous yield curve inversion, September, October 19. What's your take also on that, in terms of, it feels like a bit of that derivative bomb, the sensation?
Well, so, you know, it's more difficult to say what the reverberations are going to be through the U.S. banking system, because the Federal Reserve has set up these facilities to ensure that the sins of the past do not recur. And that's why, even though you're right, the Fed kept it under, they probably pushed their legal limit in terms of how long they could keep that information under wraps. But I think it's going to come down to the idea of stigma, and whether or not, if there is disruption in the overnight lending market, if the banks are willing to use some of the new facilities that the Fed has created, such that there's not a repeat of the repo madness that we saw in 2019. So if the banks allow themselves to be identified as weak players, which they didn't have to last time, but if the banks were to go that route, if the Fed had the power to force it, and they've been trying to get banks to participate in this new standing repo facility, and they have not been getting a warm reception, because again, you don't want to show your hand. But I would say this much. Big U.S. banks have de-risked in a big way. Same cannot be said of small, medium, mid-sized banks in the United States. And the thing that is spoken of the least, especially given, you know, you've got 82.5% of New York City workers that are back on the payroll since the pandemic hit, and yet you've only got 40% of the office space occupied. There's a massive disconnect there, and somebody holds the loans to these office, all of these mortgages, somebody's sitting on this paper, and they've been they've been extending and pretending these loans in the post-pandemic era, hoping that life would go back to what it was before. But if you've got 80% of the workforce back being employed, but only 40% of offices that are occupied, one versus the other, there's a massive disconnect there, and somebody's going to be left holding those loans. Banks will be involved.
Pension funds, again, were big investors in commercial property.
Pension funds plowed into, especially private deals. And you know, their managers sold them on the importance of having a hard asset in times of disruption. You know, all they needed to do was sit down with Christopher Cole, and he could show you the last 100 years of history and the fact that real estate is extraordinarily and painfully pro-cyclical during times of disruption. So that, I think, is more than derivatives. I think commercial real estate, especially because it's such a global entity right now, and so many people have poured money into it. Private equity and has poured money into the global commercial real estate market and into multifamily and residential in the United States. These are the things I think are not spoken about enough, because somebody's got debt against these properties.
Correct. And there's no income on it anymore, and there's no view that it's likely to return with everybody working from home. Everything is a Zoom. Everything is remote.
Yes and no. There's only 10% of the workforce that's working from home right now. That used to be around 30%. Again, firms have been spending aggressively on automating.
Yeah.
That's what they've been spending their money on. So the same number of jobs simply are not there.
Yeah. So we're already delaboring for the AI robotic world to a large degree. We're already bridging.
That was dramatically amplified and accelerated in a post-pandemic world, because there's this lovely notion that worker empowerment. It sounds great. This is election season. Let's sing it to the hills. Why are corporations just going to roll over? I understand that labor costs are increasing, and rightly so, because the pendulum, it swung too far. That said, where have they been invested most aggressively? In trying to replace human beings with machines.
Correct. There's something going on in farmland. Here's our sketch of story. So UK farmers are being encouraged, and they of a certain generation in many ways, to almost be paid to retire and resign. There's been a lot of big oligarchies accumulating farmland in the US. There's a lot of doomsday speakers. There's just a recent name that I was referring to, who was talking about there's likely going to be a supply chain shortage of agricultural foods. We're kind of inverting Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're no longer talking Bugatti Veyrons and private jet flights. We're talking about food provision. And I'm trying to check the names. James Aitken has been appearing, and he's been talking a little bit about, as a macro strategist, how the back end of this year could be deep supply shortages of basics. So we're talking about food supply. And there's something also going on in farmland that's kind of, that seem like too disparate, but is farmland going to be the new commercial real estate because of that yield, that requirement, the scaling of farming? Already farming's become so efficient. They've big scale business. It's so automated. You can have a family of four running 60,000 hectares with the equipment and all that, quite advanced. And it was reduced to being very efficient and highly marginal. Most of the profit was being soaked up by the supermarket chain, who was buying real hard, had real scale, and then was packaging and marketing. Are we going to see a return of joy? Because in the 30s, many people don't know this, but historically, farmland had a bit of a bubble post in the lead up to the 30s. What's your take on the agri-producing ground and land?
Well, so this is not an area of expertise. However, I can tell you that one of the greater risks is that there is leverage in this space. And yet, since the 1930s up until today, the one variable that has not changed is Mother Nature.
Yeah.
So the risk is there. And because there's such a need, because you're pulling this, you know, third of the world's wheat, effectively, potentially off the market. And I don't anticipate that that's going to be the case. I think you get wheat out of Ukraine. I think you get some, but I think that there's still going to be a gaping hole that's left behind in terms of what we don't get from them. But as long as Mother Nature behaves, I think that we're going to be fine. If she doesn't, God help us. Yeah. Because there is leverage. There is leverage in farmland. Farmland has been one of the hottest, quietest, hottest asset classes, the place to be.
Yes, and you don't see that stopping anytime soon, or you think it's already overbought?
Well, look, people right now are desperately seeking out safe asset classes. I'm sorry, I forgot to do my air quotes, safe asset classes. So and there's trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of dry powder in the hands of private equity firms that continue to raise these mega funds. They continue to be in the marketplace raising fresh money. So when you have a situation where money has to be deployed or you're not going to get paid a fee on it, then you're going to get some of the stupidest deals in all of mankind's history.
Yeah. And that's the problem. Too much liquidity chasing the logical trade. It's been fascinating, Daniel. With all the risks potentially to the downside on equities, what would be your three bullets without on a non-advisory basis, but your three bullet defense strategy for these times? If I were to just look over your shoulder to the next Quill Intelligence feather letter, by the way, everyone should be registered and consider your service at Quill Intelligence, Danielle DiMartino Booth. What would be the top three bullets of defense for surviving and thriving in these crazy times?
So the monies have already been allocated to many states and municipalities, and because of the high interest rate environment, you've seen municipal bonds in the United States really take it on the chin. If you're a holder, then you're fine. You're sitting on potential unrealized losses. That being said, there are going to be the opposites of Illinois out there. There are going to be very safe places to park your money. I would also point you to companies with strong balance sheets that are in the staples universe that have a dividend that's not going to be at risk, because the one thing that we saw with the post-pandemic era was this wave of companies canceling or suspending their dividends. So if you can get protection on that front, then certainly do so. And I stick with precious metals, so I think that's something of a cop-out trade, but I will say this much. I think that the home building sector, consumer discretionary sector, given, again, it's a midterm year, I wouldn't fall into the value trap of saying they're down so much, I need to jump back in. There's going to be plenty of up days where you think you kind of psych yourself out, but be very careful in this space. And that's what we've been advising to our clients is industrials, consumer discretionary. And by the way, energy's gone really far. And one must wonder also if energy is also a value trap. And there's so much money that's been made in this space. I would caution against one other thing, and that's that if you're looking inside the U.S. high yield market, the most exposed sector, last generation it was energy, this generation it's healthcare. Yeah. And that's a little bit less obvious of a sector to be at risk, but that is indeed where some of the riskiest paper is, which some people would think of healthcare demographics being a sure thing. Be very careful and do your research.
That was an amazingly good and succinct. You triggered me on one more if you've got the time. Equities, some people feel that equities are a safe place generally in a place of inflation. Of course, you've already been very specific about which areas of equities. It's very broad brush. But one of the concerns that did get created with this buyback realm that I was failing to mention, and I just thought I'd bring in, many companies borrowed to purchase back stock. Surely that must be an absolute poison pill that is going to detonate, and making sure you're not holding, and if you are of a trading ilk, possibly judicious, well-managed short positions on the big buyback parade that are not income generative. So you stay out of the ones like Apple that are real cash machines. But there are a lot of second-rate companies, so General Electric, IBM, fallen angels that have had quite a big history of buybacks and must be significantly more leveraged. Simon Black did something on Coca-Cola where he compared it a decade ago to more recently, and everything was down. The debt levels were up. The earnings were down, the growth rates were down, but the share price was a 3x. And is this not a sweet spot for real re-ratings to the downside in the equities? Or is the inflation trade just don't go against probably what's a double digits inflation rate if you're trying to be too smart?
Well, you can be too smart, or you can be overly long equities going into an earnings recession. So inflation cuts both ways. And as long as companies are not able to pass along price increases, and if price pressures do become pronounced, as we're starting to hear from some companies, and they have very murky outlooks going forward to the rest of the year. Remember, the second and third fourth quarters in US GDP growth were supposed to make up for the weak first quarter. And now what we're seeing is the first quarter's coming in somewhere around 1%, and the second quarter's drifting down towards 1.5%. So this major improvement that we're supposed to see, which should be reflected in earnings and equities being the safe haven that you describe, that's not going to happen if we're in an earnings recession.
That's it. I think that's, we'll end on that. It's the stag in the stagflation that's going to curb the growth and the consumer. Is inflation not the most enrichment tool for the billionaire class with assets and devaluing debt, and the most impoverishing tool for the middle and the bottom, as a final throwaway comment?
Without question, absolutely without question. It's look, what monetary policy has done for the future of societal peace or strife is something that I hope is written in history plainly, that this is something that was very much exacerbated by monetary policy, making sure that only the 1% got the fruits of policies that were being made.
Daniel DeMartino Booth, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for, once again, your great insights. Look forward to releasing this. You've got a real fan club. We appreciate having you on. In your own words, where do people go to engage with you?
So please come to quillintelligence.com. I actually do fewer podcasts than I used to, but we have quite a few of your viewers who are now paying subscribers, which makes me very happy. But come to quillintelligence.com and follow me on Twitter. By the way, if you become a part of Quill Intelligence and the reading, the subscribing universe, you get access to my private Twitter feed. And I say things there that I wouldn't say in public. So
love it. We want the dirty. Daniel, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Have a great week ahead.
Bye-bye
for now.